Welcome to the Choose FI Radio Podcast, Episode 5, Why Everyone Needs Dave Ramsey and Why You Should Ignore Him.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
Well, we're back to the studio. 2017 is here. This is going to be our first podcast of the year, and thankfully, Brad is here with me again today. Hi, Brad.
Hey, Jonathan. How's it going? Happy New Year.
Thank you. Thank you. Hope you had a good time over the holidays.
I did indeed.
Yeah, yep. Spend some time with your family, decompress a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, it was definitely nice and relaxing. We went up to New York to visit our family, so yeah, good times.
Awesome. Well, so as the article indicated, or as the title indicated earlier, today we're going to be talking about Dave Ramsey and specifically how we should be channeling that information in the community that we're in, the financial independence space. And so I guess to start off, let me kind of give you know, my history with Dave. I've listened to many podcasts in my day, and I've read probably even more blogs. And over that period of time, one name stands out to me really more than any of the others, and that's Dave Ramsey. And I have been impressed by him for really over 15 years. Now, Brad and I, we have big egos probably, but there's nothing really special about us. We're sixth or seventh generation media personalities. And I don't want to say that we're a dime a dozen, but there's a lot more of us to choose from. But Dave, he was one of the first generation personal finance coaches. Nobody was doing this back in the 90s. And apparently, you know, his backstory, I think he had $1 million real estate portfolio and he crashed hard, I think, into bankruptcy. And then he pivoted and he started a radio show helping people avoid his mistakes. And about the same time, he created a small book called Financial Peace, and he started offering it as a free resource to his church. But the radio show gave him a platform to sell this book nationwide, and he turned it into a multi-million dollar dynasty. So he created a business model that predated blogging, and that's pretty cool. So, I mean, if you want more information about that, I'm sure you can find it on his website. But Dave gives great no-nonsense advice to people that have just generally gotten in over their heads and need some help digging their way out. And he was inspirational to me, even though I ignored a lot of his advice when I was taking out my loans for pharmacy school. His message, you know, that debt carries emotional stress, limits your options, and, you know, has the potential to ruin your life. You know, it stays with me. It's a powerful message. And I think that really everybody would benefit from listening to him. So I would not be here today doing this podcast if it weren't for Dave. And I want to start out by saying that I really do owe him a debt of gratitude for that. But one of the things that I always found very frustrating about Dave is his unyielding stance on debt. He lumps it all together. So student loan debt, real estate debt, credit card debt, all evil. And many people would call a show, I was one of them, to give their specific situation and try to get them to give their blessing to take out some form of debt to achieve their goal. And I will just say 100% of the time, he never caved. He didn't cave. And to be fair, he's kind of locked in. He's built a media empire around saying that he would never take out debt. And he's made millions. But Brad and I, we have not made millions. So we are not locked in. And we can change our opinion as we get new and better information. And in fact, Brad, wouldn't you say we're crowdsourcing our information?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, we want our community to be involved. We want to learn from all different blogs. We're trying to experiment and figure out what works. So yeah, we certainly don't have any sacred cows. We're just trying to figure this out along with you guys.
Absolutely. And I would say even more so, we're not gurus. It feels kind of slimy, and we just avoid them in general. So we're not gurus, just regular guys, just sharing what we've learned so far. And we're hoping that this will encourage you to share what you know with us, and we can, you know, get better together. So now, literally for me, this is 15 years later, and Brad and I are building this platform, and I wanted to take this opportunity to review and evaluate Dave's teaching philosophies, where we line up, where we go our separate ways. I think this is going to be a useful exercise for me, and I think it's what's going to make today's podcast so interesting. And what I'm going to do is I'm actually going to run these ideas by Brad, who has never followed Dave, has really no interest in Dave, I guess, outside of me dragging him along. And I want to get his input as well. So I hope you enjoy this.
Yeah, I think that's going to be really interesting for the audience just because I know essentially nothing about Dave Ramsey. I know he has some steps. He has something called the debt snowball, I believe. And I also know that he's very anti-credit card. And I am potentially, you know, very pro credit card in many instances.
Yes, you are. I love
people
it.
Know about travel hacking. So yeah, I mean, I think this will be kind of cool to come in this, you know, into this as me essentially knowing nothing, and we can talk through it, see where we agree, disagree, and kind of go from there.
Absolutely. All right. So let's talk about the Dave Ramsey show. So Dave Ramsey has 7 baby steps that he walks you through, and you know, they're pretty simple. So baby step 1, get an emergency fund of $1,000. So the first step, get an emergency fund of $1,000 in the bank. And Dave says that this is to prevent Murphy from knocking on your door. Because if you don't have a plan, Murphy's going to come. And, you know, I think that's a great idea. I don't think, Brad?
Who's Murphy?
All right. So really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. Wow. So Murphy is, you ever heard of Murphy's Law?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So, you know, what can go wrong will go wrong. And that's who Murphy is. So Murphy's, he's coming for you if you don't have a plan. Brad has always had a plan, so never had to worry about it. You know, I don't take the small stuff for granted. If everybody had some of these basic concepts locked down, then payday lenders would be out of business. But yet I know people personally that have had to use payday lenders, and they're just one emergency away from total financial disaster. I know people that don't have checking accounts. Yeah, that's crazy.
But they do not have a checking account?
Yes. So, you know, I think let's not assume that everybody is in the exact same place as we are, you know, from an education perspective or a financial, you know, acumen perspective. You know, people are in different places in life. So for that person, that $1,000 will make a world of difference.
Yeah, I completely agree about that. And I also want to take a step back and say, it's easy for us to sit here and say, we're reasonably intelligent. You know, we know we've been researching financial independence for months and years, and what's quote unquote obvious to us is not obvious to everyone. Right. And just from hearing about baby step number 1, I completely agree. I mean, if you don't have $1,000 saved up, your house is on fire. Your hair is on fire, right? Like that is an emergency. That is a true emergency, because your life, you have to, I mean, think about the stress of that, right? Every single day, if something happened, if you blow a tire and you have to spend whatever it is, $100, $200 to get a new tire, like that's a catastrophe. I'm kind of annoyed, obviously, if I get a flat tire or have to spend a couple $100 that I didn't want to, but does that impact my life at all? No, it impacts my life zero. But man, that sure as heck would if I had no money. I couldn't imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, Dave spent years and years just on radio shows with people that are that close to the edge. And $1,000 can be enough to stave off financial disaster. And he's very protective about that. In fact, I love it. Keep your grubby hands off it. Don't touch it. It's for an emergency. It's not so you can get your nails done. It's an emergency. So clarify what that is. Make sure you have that. And I think that's a great baseline. I don't think anybody would argue with that. Just get $1,000 in the bank. You know, for much of this show, Brad and I are going to assume that you have a lot of the basics under control. This, you know, we're not the Dave Ramsey show. For the most part, we're not trying to get you from the financial cliff. What we're trying to do is help you optimize your life and take it to the next level. But this is an amazing conversation to have. So we're going to assume that you have a checking account, that you don't use payday loans, that you know how to balance a budget, that you know how to live within your means. And then what we're planning on doing is opening up some advanced techniques to help you game the system and get more for every single dollar that you bring home. But if you don't understand how all this works and you're starting from scratch, go buy the book, The Total Money Makeover. It will change your life. I have no problem recommending that. Okay, so that was step 1. Step 2, baby step 2, pay off all debt except for your mortgage. All right, so in this step, Dave recommends using what he calls the debt snowball. So you make a list of all your debts. You're going to rank them in order from the largest to the smallest. You're going to make the minimum payments on all the debts. Then you're going to throw every extra little bit you have onto the smallest debt. And you're going to then congratulate yourself, knock that one out. And then you're going to roll what you are paying into that into the next one. So every extra spare penny goes into the next one. You repeat this until you're completely done. There are some obvious problems with this.
Right. I think the first one that jumps out to me is, you know, most people would argue, most financial experts, quote unquote, would say pay the debt with the highest interest rate. Right.
And there's a name for that. Mathematicians, people that can do basic math, often refer to the debt avalanche. So instead, you know, make a list of all your debts and you do exactly the opposite. You rank them by interest rate. You would take a look at the ones with the highest interest rate and you'd pay that one off. And then you roll it to the next one with the slightly lower interest rate and so on and so forth until you repeat when finished.
Yeah, but I actually like Ramsey's point of view here. I mean, because the debt avalanche really, that takes the psychology out of this.
Yes.
Right? Like psychology with finances, it's essential. I mean, for most people who are living paycheck to paycheck, cash flow is everything.
100%.
Right? So, I mean, if they can pay off that smallest debt, then either A, they can just simply not have that payment from month to month, or B, as I imagine we're going to go with Ramsey is, with the snowball, is you take that smallest debt payment that you would have been paying and then pay it, add that to your next smallest debt, yeah. Right? Is that fair?
Yeah, no, 100%. You're stealing my thunder from me, Brad. No, I'm with you. So I think you got to be smart about this. You know, I don't think everything is either one way or the other. I've kind of come to, let's use a common sense hybrid on this one. For instance, if you have a payday loan that's at 200% interest rate, and then you have a credit card, so your payday loan, you owe $1,200 on a payday loan, and it's at a 200% interest rate, or you owe $100 on a credit card and it's at a 14% interest rate. What does Brad always say? Your hair is on fire. Pay off the payday loan. That is killing you. Forget it. Take care of the payday loan and then come down and deal with the smaller quantity. But in general, what I would probably recommend you do is group all your smaller ones together. Try and tackle those first. You know, if they're kind of comparable in rate, focus on the ones with a higher interest rate. Take care of those first. If you have any payday loans, go ask for help from a family member. I mean, this is the time to just get someone else involved and do whatever you have to do to swear that it will never happen again, but get out of that because it'll ruin your life. That's the last time I mentioned payday loans, so I promise.
Yeah, hopefully none of you out there ever contemplating payday loans, but yeah, clearly I like that hybrid approach. You know, if something is extraordinary, then pay it off. I mean,
Give you an example. So I'm one of these people that have bought into the debt model for many years before I finally am now coming back to the other side. And there were different decisions that made sense to me at the time to get there. And that's fine. But I had a car payment of $350 a month. It was a $15,000 car. And that is at a 2.5% interest rate. And I have a student loan that at the time is 100 and some odd thousand. And that was at a 6% interest rate. Brad, which one would you pay off?
My normal inclination would be pay off the 6%.
No, I was with you. I mean, the payment wasn't killing me. And it was just predictable math on that one. I was not close to the edge. They were both big numbers where I couldn't have either of them done in within a year. It was going to take me longer than that. So in that particular scenario, it just made sense for me to go ahead and knock out the 6%. I mean, I think it's one of those things where if you're talking about rolling these up within a month or two, if you just focus on them, then I would say 100% the snowball is fine. But let's not look at everything inside of this vacuum. Everybody's situation is a little bit different, and that's what they're talking about. If it's going to take you a year or 2 years to pay something off and those interest rates have real numbers attached to it, get your mind right with the psychology. Get some little wins by paying off the $500, $600 couch payments, all the dumb stuff that you signed up for. Get all that taken care of. And then once you're done with that, why don't you move? Once you're at those higher dollar amounts, go ahead and look at the interest rate and work your way down from there. So Dave is selling a simplistic one size fits all package. And I get it. And it's fine. I don't really take issue with it. But that's not the space that a lot of our audience is going to be in. And so, you know, we're allowed to do both. We can use some common sense and we use some psychology and we can use some math.
Yeah. And I think that's important what Jonathan just said about the one size fits all. And I've found this having produced content for my other websites over the last couple of years is you lose a lot of nuance sometimes when you give advice to a sizable audience. And I think it's important for you as a consumer of information to say, okay, this is someone producing content for millions. I need to look at this and say, okay, 90% of it or 80% of it, whatever it is, fits for me, but I need to adjust X, Y, and Z. I think that's essential. Don't ever take anything as gospel. Just take the essential information, glean it, and then make the adjustments you need to make for your life.
All right. So either of those models will work, but I do realize the emotional power of getting rid of smaller debts and rolling the payments into the next one. So I want y'all to go through this little scenario with me. And this is, I'm sure, very common for most of middle-class America. You have a mortgage, it's $1,500. You have a two car payments, one's $350, one's $250. You have a student loan payment that's $300 a month. You pay $500 a month on food, and that's on a good month. When you go to the restaurants and you get out of control, it goes all the way up to $1,000. You have about $500 in recurring bills through cable, cell phone bills, electric bill, that sort of thing. And then you have a little bit of credit card debt. Nothing fancy, but your minimum payment is $115 a month. So you add that up, and your cost of living is $42,180. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. I would say that's probably it. Brad, is that an entry level middle class lifestyle right there?
Yeah.
For most people?
It looks reasonable.
Okay. So once you take a look at all those, let's take a look at what it would mean to actually get out of debt for that person. And regardless of how you did it, if you stacked it from smallest to largest, let's say you did just take that opportunity to do what Dave says and pay off all of your debt. So everything except for the mortgage. You get rid of the car payments, the student loans, and the credit card bill. So those are the three things that you do, and it takes you 2 years to do it, but you take all Dave's advice and you do it. If you cut all of those things from your life, that is going to save you about $10,000 a year. And it's not just $10,000. It is like getting a massive tax-free raise. That is money that is then there for you for whatever you want. It is free from Medicare, FICA, state tax, Medicaid. It is totally yours. Now, I'm not saying you don't pay taxes on it, but you are already paying taxes on it. And then what was left, you were having to send it to those different types of debt. So now that is $10,000 of take-home money that can go for whatever you want. And you can use that to start a business. You can use that to experiment. You can just put that into an investment account. And because you've done that, not only is it now making money for you, but because you don't need that to survive anymore, your financial independence number, which is a number that maybe Brad can talk about a little bit, is much, much less.
Yeah. And that's funny. As Jonathan was talking, I was, you know, waiting to jump in actually, because I think of it differently. I think of it in terms of that financial independence number. So under this scenario, and I know it's hard to hear these numbers and not see them on a paper, but we're saying this person reduced their cost of living from 42,000 and changed to 30,000. And they also, a mortgage is part of that. So theoretically, they could take all that extra money they were spending and pay that additional principal on a mortgage. Now, that obviously is personal preference. I'm not sure necessarily that we would recommend that. But if you're talking about financial independence, it's just a simple function of your annual costs. And we say if you use what's known as the 4% rule, which is if you take your total pot of money, you can essentially withdraw 4% of it per year and live on that money. And in theory, that money should last forever, that pot of money, because you're getting a larger return, hopefully a 7-8% return, and you're only pulling out 4%. It should, based on some calculations that you can find online, that should last in perpetuity, hopefully, in a perfect world scenario. So that $30,000 a year, you would, the 4%, the way that it works is you multiply that by 25, okay? So 30,000 times 25 is $750,000.
I was about to say, he's doing math live. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, let's hope I'm right on that. And that is the pot of money you would need to live off of to be financially independent. So, right, so most people in the FI community would say you are financially independent if you have $750,000 in that pot and your cost of living is $30,000 a year.
And then what is it, Brad, if you're at 42,000? So you didn't pay those off.
Yeah, so I mean, it would be over $1 million in that case. Yeah. So just by paying off that, you know, whatever it is, you know, little less than $1,000 a month makes it so that you need $250,000 less in that pot of money. So it makes a huge, huge difference. And I mean, taking this a step further, if you could pay off that mortgage, then that's $18,000 of that 30, then you're only at $12,000 a year. Then you're talking about Jacob style from ERE, right? Like that's a totally different ballgame.
I've never felt guilty when reading a blog, and I felt guilty when reading Jacob's blog. It's a great blog and everybody should read it. I think it's earlyretirementextreme.com. But I just feel like I've done something wrong when I'm reading that one.
Yeah, seriously, if you're not living in a trailer and living off of $8,000 a year. But, you know, in this scenario that Jonathan laid out, like, you know, this is how you think about financial independence. It's cut down your expenses as much as you can, pay off this debt that's just hanging over you. And then you just have ongoing expenses, right? Which are just basically whatever utility bills you have, et cetera, and your food and entertainment. I mean, for most people, it's hard to spend more than a couple $1,000s a month in that, just in a normal course of life, right?
Right.
And then, you know, you're at a scenario where your yearly expenses are 30,000 or even less, potentially 20,000, and you only need $500,000 in a retirement account or in your pot of money to be at FI. I mean, that's pretty remarkable.
And honestly, that is the way I think. When you hear me talk about getting rid of a recurring expense, it's that 4% rule that's going through my mind. And for me, and I know that's not realistic, but I don't think about that when I spend a lot of money on something one time. If it's a one-time purchase, that doesn't, to me, it doesn't click in my brain that that's an ongoing thing that's going to increase my retirement number. It's a one and done type transaction. But when you have recurring expenses like your cell phone bill and your cable bill, those are things that are preventing you from retiring early. Now, I probably do need to step it up and look at my one-time purchases, but as it is, that's the way my mind works. So one of the things that I've noticed in these baby steps, and again, it goes back to, you know, he's trying to keep it very simple, but in his course, even in his extended financial peace course, he doesn't really give you actionable tips at decreasing the cost of your life. If I remember correctly, his advice goes something like, have a yard sale, sell your car, work a second job, deliver pizzas. That seems to be his go-to. Now, somebody could correct me. I know Brad can't, but somebody can correct me if I'm wrong about that. You know, maybe that's fine for three bullet points on a sheet of paper, but we're not selling a finely packaged book out to millions of people. We're doing a living podcast and a blog to go along with it where we can create content. And we want to do better than that. We want to actually give you extremely actionable tips that show you exactly what you can do that are simple, that are doable, that are not going to make you live in a shed out back, but are actually going to empower you to decrease the cost of your life by 20, 30 grand a year. So we'll come back to that in another article. We've got one coming up that we're going to be doing called the Ultimate Costco Meal Plan. And we're basically looking at slashing that food budget completely in half. All right. So now this is the other one. This is the sacred cow. This is probably the one where I really take issue with it. Dave Ramsey will tell you to hold off on your match with your 401k while you're paying off debt. I cannot in good conscience make that absolute recommendation to anybody. I have no problem with you not maxing out your 401k. No big deal. That's fine. But we don't walk away from free money. You always do the match.
Yeah, I'll go a step further. That's the first time I've ever heard that. I think that's the worst advice I've ever heard in my entire life. And you should not listen to that. That would almost, I mean, to me, that would like almost invalidate someone as a complete moron. But but we'll go with, you know, maybe he has some legitimate reason, right, but
we'll talk about it. Well, I'll try to help sell you on his idea, but know that even after I can see his point, I still walk away from it. So he makes the case that you are being chased by the cheetah. So you are in the field and the cheetah is running after you, and that this is a short-term thing and you need every extra penny you can get, because he says the cheetah, you always say your hair's on fire. And maybe for some very specific situations where someone is close to the edge, like a payday lending situation, I think probably we got to, again, keep in mind that this audience is important. He's focusing on people dangerously close to the edge. Maybe, but you absolutely can't apply that to everyone. And he is sending this book out and millions of people are purchasing it. And if you have some debt at 5%, you never pass up on doubling your money, which is 100%. So you put, you know, $100 in the bank every 2 weeks, your employer matches it at 100%. And you don't pass that up to pay down 5% interest. That is extremely stupid math.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, clearly, if we're talking these ridiculous payday loans, that's a different scenario at 200% interest. But yeah, I mean, from an outsider's perspective, he's not even personal finance 101. He's personal finance kindergarten. And unfortunately, and I don't mean to sound like a jerk or elitist in any way, shape, or form.
You're going to have some people hating on you for that.
Yeah,
I mean, that's please fine. Don't hate on us. We want good comments. Leave us kind comments.
No. I would put that in a positive light. Okay. Yeah. And I mean this sincerely. There are tens upon tens of millions of people who are at that personal finance elementary school level. And that's not their fault. That's not me being a jerk and saying I'm fantastic. I don't mean that in any way. I think we don't ever get any education on finance, right? I mean, and that is a crime. And Dave Ramsey, from my perspective, does a wonderful service to this country that he is helping people realize that this is an emergency. If you don't have $1,000 saved up, that is an emergency. If you have credit card debt or payday loans, that is a true emergency. He is doing such a service to America. So believe me, I sincerely mean that. But
you have graduated past what he can offer you. Right. I 100% once, and I feel the same way.
And hopefully our audience has graduated beyond much of that. And many of you have not. We're going to get to some things, baby step three, about having months of savings. Many of you don't have months of savings, and that's perfectly fine. We can even make an argument whether that makes sense or not. It depends on how you consider savings, certainly.
Right, 100%.
But that said, hopefully our audience can take Dave's advice.
And that's what this is, isn't it? I mean, we're trying to figure out what can we still use, what's really good, and where can you just say, you know what, Dave, love you, I agree to disagree.
Yep, agreed.
Okay, so here's a math question. I don't even know if we can answer this today, but it's one that I've thought about. I just haven't come up with the answer yet. So if you have an answer on this, I'd love to hear your opinion. Brad and I really do want to make this a crowdsourced podcast that brings you in. And so if you've thought about this and you came up with a decision, package it for us and let us know. We would love your input on this. So if you are financially able to max out your 401k and have money left over to pay down debt, but it's going to take you now 4 years instead of 2 years, would you? And what would be the deciding factor?
Right. Yeah, that's not something I've ever considered before. I mean, so pay down debt in that scenario.
So you're, and what let's are we say, talking let's about? Say, all right, so let's say we're talking, because we're now, let's say it's a significant number, right? So let's say we're talking about 60 grand that you got to pay off. You have a pretty high income, because that's why this makes it more appealing, because a 401k goes in pre-tax. So you're in a 30% maybe marginal tax bracket, maybe even a 40% marginal tax bracket. And so you can completely max out your 401ks, no problem, and have money to pay it down. But just due to the numbers, it's going to take you an extra 2 years to pay off the debt if you do it that way.
Yeah. So to me, it depends what kind of debt we're talking about, right? If we're talking about
let's just say a mortgage, it's 6% right? interest, 6% interest. Doesn't matter, but it's a 6% interest rate.
Yeah, that's tough. I think there's not an easy answer to that. Like, right? Like,
I don't have one. I've been trying to figure out what number I would need. And I frankly, is it okay to say I don't know?
Yeah, of course it is.
Can I leave it out there and someone can leave us a comment and then we'll come back to it in a few weeks? Is that an okay format? Well,
I mean, I think without a doubt, not only that, but you actually have this in your personal life, right?
Yeah.
Like you have student loan debt. Right.
I made a choice, but I wonder what would have happened the other way and what would be, can the math get us somewhere? And I don't know what the math is. You're an accountant. Help me.
Putting me on the spot.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure. I think with all this stuff, it's not just straight math. And I think that's what I want to get across more than anything. Like if you listen to the ultra optimizers, they would disagree with me. They would say this
everything is math.
It's a math equation. That's all you can consider. I reject that.
I'm with you. And here's why. Because I have been more frugal than I would normally be in order to pay down debt. I've paid down a lot of debt. And I made a choice not to max out my 401k. I couldn't necessarily figure out what the math was going to be. I knew I was going to get the match. And I'm very glad I did. I have no regrets about that. It has absolutely done marvels for my 401k to take advantage of the match. But I did not max out my 401 because I needed that psychological boost of that extra 10 grand or whatever it was to get those loans paid off. And I'm 4 months away or 3 months or 2 months or something like that. I should be done in April from my loans being completely gone. And I'm so glad that I did not squander the extra 10 grand because you know what, if you don't see that dial move down and get closer to zero, at some point you might just give up, or maybe you have a life change. Like your wife stops working or you have a child or other things happen. You don't know what's coming. But when you have debt that's paid off, that's a post-tax dollar raise. That's the way I always think about debt that's gone. It's a post-tax dollar raise. And where else do you find that?
Yeah, agreed. Totally. And in my personal instance, we did not max out our 401ks either. Honestly, that's not something I think I've ever mentioned on any podcast before. But I did up to obviously the match. I think I put in maybe 10 or 11% of my income plus the match. You know, that was a decent number every year, right? And that was something I was comfortable with. Now, I think if you read an article, we're going to talk to hopefully Brandon from The Mad Scientist at some point on one of our podcasts about his article talking specifically about how you should max these things out. And, you know, he has looked at this every which way and comes out, even if you have to pull the money out with the penalty. That
I'm
still
so
worth
excited
it.
That we're going to be doing that. That is going to be a lot of fun. And these questions are going to come back up. I'm not just letting this lie.
No,
I want
no,
someone
no.
to tell me what I missed out.
Yeah,
on.
Without a doubt. But I mean, for me, it was also psychological. It was, I would rather have this money in my investment account or my bank account than in this 401k, which at that time, naively, I wasn't aware of ways to pull that money out. So to me, it was locked in there until I was 59 and a half. And that was not good enough for me. So for me, psychologically, just like you, Jonathan, wanted to pay off your student loans, I like the psychological satisfaction of knowing that I could pay off my mortgage tomorrow.
Yeah, that's huge, man. Right? I get that. And you got to know what is the math on that as well. I mean, let's say you have the option. Well, you know what? We're not going to go into that. We're going to save that one for Brandon and we're going to get his input and have that conversation. So let's move on. 30 minutes in and we're on baby step three, but I guess it took Dave an entire book, so we're not doing too bad. Okay. So baby step three, get 3 to 6 months of expenses in savings. So I am right there at the door. It took me a very long time. And I think shouldn't take everybody this much. Hopefully you don't have as much debt as I had if you were kind of working through that stage, but it took me a long time to work through step two. So I am now getting close to step three. And I've shared with you how I've parted with Dave on a few things, but I would say that in general, I found his advice useful. And whether or not I would have come to those same conclusions on my own, that's the process that I took. So this is one that Brad has chided me on, if you will, several times over the last couple months. And that is the importance of having a solid emergency fund. And Brad specifically has stated that he wouldn't be able to go to sleep at night if he didn't have a fully funded emergency fund. I think it's just kind of that poor kid in me. I've never had money as a child or you know, even an adult. I wasn't a frugal person. It came in and I burned a hole in it until it was gone. And I just did that all the way up through maybe the age of 16 or 17. And then right as I was starting to learn some of these financial techniques and why it was important, at that point, I was already going to be going to pharmacy school and I knew I was going to be incurring six figures in debt. So I've always been close to the edge. I've never not been close to the edge. And so for me in my 30s now, this will be the first time that I've ever been in a position where I can start thinking about things like an emergency fund. So I'm not saying I feel safe here, but I'm probably going to feel weird when I have it because I'll have spent more of my life not having it than having it.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very cool to watch you as you go along here, right? We talked about this in episode 4, which was where I interviewed you. And I was honestly pretty surprised how close you live, quote unquote, to the edge, right? But you had legitimate reason for it. You know, you said, I have a six-figure income that's coming in reliably every biweekly, whatever it was. That made sense, right? And your goal was to pay down your student loan debt. And that makes sense to me.
And it's calculating the chance of that emergency. And then if that happened, what would my backup plan be? And so I'm not going to roll into the credit card specific and roll all that back out again. But if I were to have an emergency and incur $5,000 of expenses, I mean, I could cover it. It wouldn't end me. So anyways, going forward, I am still curious. You know, Brad, you talked last time that you had these funds and I'm kind of curious. Tell me about your emergency fund strategy. So 3 to 6 months of expenses, where is that? I mean, is that just in a bank account? Do you put that in a taxable account? What do you do?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, in all honesty, we probably have about 12 to 24 months of expenses.
Awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and I guess it depends what your definition is, right? So,
well, I'm not counting a 401k, right?
Yeah. I mean, clearly,
when you
no
asked
401k.
Me about my emergency fund last time, I obviously do have a 401k. I was not counting that.
Right. Without a doubt. Yeah. You do not want to tap your 401k early. I know there are different avenues to do that. That is not something we promote in almost every scenario. That's a bad idea. So, yes, clearly we're taking any retirement accounts and not considering them here. So I guess, are we saying that savings or emergency funds are any type of regular, traditional savings or taxable accounts, as people would call them?
Well, I guess that's what I'm asking. I don't have any problem. Is a VTSAX, is that for you? Would that be a place that you could have it? Because you can access it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what I struggle with. So yeah, I mean, if we're talking the amount, you know, the money that I have in savings or investments outside of retirement accounts, then yeah, I mean, we have a significant amount in Vanguard, in VTSAX. We also have a Fidelity account, I think, where we have some individual stocks, and I don't recommend that generally, but we also have—
I kind of want to try it.
Yeah, I mean, it can be kind of fun. There's I invest in Berkshire Hathaway,
yep.
And there's a company here in Richmond called Markel, which is actually people call like a mini Berkshire.
Yeah, no.
It's a really impressive company. So I don't recommend people necessarily starting with individual stocks, but this is a small—
Yeah, I think it's a percentage. I mean, we all have rules that we follow and then rules that we break. And so one of ours is, I think Brad and I have settled on this, VTSAX all the way.
Yep, agreed.
Very, very set on that. Probably not going to change that opinion that I can see maybe, and probably be more passionate about that as we bring Jim Collins on the show. But we always deviate from the mean at some point.
Right.
And I plan on building a small little fund on the side. It will be, you know, less than 10% of my portfolio because I'm a man and I need to.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can't be dogmatic about anything. I mean, we need to experiment, have a little fun. I mean, it's not like you're going and blowing it on a Corvette. You know, I'm investing in Berkshire Hathaway, which is a wonderful company. So I can sleep at night with that. But so also we have an online bank that's giving at this point in time less than 1% interest. So this is not lighting the world on fire in any way, shape, or form. And that actually gets into a separate question, which is Jonathan said VTSAX could be your emergency savings, right? You know, because you
don't steal my thunder, Brad. Yeah. I have a life hack for individuals coming up. So do hold on to that thought. Okay. We're coming back to it.
Okay. I do just want to finish this thought real quick. I'm going to try not to steal his thunder, but this is something that I've thought of previously, which is, does it make sense for me to leave all this money in our online bank or in a savings account, whatever you want to call it, when that takes a day or two or three to transfer back to our checking account? So, I mean, it's not immediately accessible. Right. Whereas you can sell mutual funds and transfer them back from Vanguard in the same 2 to 3 days.
Right.
So does that eliminate the need for a traditional savings account? I don't know the answer, but I've definitely thought maybe we should be moving that money that's just sitting there in this stupid online bank getting 0.75% interest and put it into VTSAX.
I'm going to tell you my mini conclusion, and feel free, if there is a guest that knows more about this than I do, when they come on the show later, they can refer to this and say, Jonathan, I have some advice for you. That'd be fine. But tell me what you think about this. Is this a good plan? So my plan, as I start to develop this 3 to 6 months of expenses, so I think we're talking, you know what, three to 10 grand, somewhere in that range. I'm thinking, let's say the average American has $3,000 to $4,000 worth of monthly expenses. Middle-class America, that meets your needs, your mortgage, car payment, you know, whatever else. That's where you're at right now. $3,000 in a bank account would be great. Maybe $3,000 in a money market or something that you can easily access. And then anything above that in VTSAX. How does that sound?
Yeah, that sounds reasonable.
It's very reasonable, middle of the road, nothing aggressive there. Now, how about, because ChooseFI is where we give you life optimization strategies, how about we upgrade that a little bit? So you potentially could be eligible for a Roth IRA. I think the Roth IRA could make the absolute perfect emergency fund, because you can withdraw contributions without a penalty and you can set up a Roth IRA in a VTSAX. Brad?
Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
So between those categories, you should be able to access 3 to 6 months worth of expenses. Pay attention there to that little Roth IRA hack, because Brad and I have some big plans for kind of creating what we like to call the blueprint. And we are going to use that tool many, many times. So just pay attention to that little nifty trick. Get a Roth IRA account set up, fund it from an early age, take advantage for life's emergencies. We'll come back to that. All right, baby step 4, invest 15% of household income into Roth IRAs and pre-tax retirement. Now, I'm going to say that for our audience, the ChooseFI audience, this is where the advice starts crashing down. First of all, Dave Ramsey, at least in his books, and he may have modified it on his online presence, he commonly assumes a 12 to 18% rate of return. And to justify that, he recommends that you use his, quote, endorsed local providers, which are, you know, active fund managers. And they're going to put you in these mutual funds that will give you these high rates of return. And most of the math equations that he uses either assume an 18% rate of return or a 12% rate of return. And frankly, you just don't see that anymore, Brad.
Yeah, I'm not sure you ever see that. That's
okay, fair. I was out of the loop when this was happening, but
that's completely unrealistic. Right. Maybe in the 1980s when interest rates were 18%.
You could publish that book in the year 2000 through 2010, yeah, given that.
No, that's crazy. I mean, I think as a matter of course, we assume maybe 8% is what we've been using. So I think we'll go with that.
Okay. So I'm good with that too. So that was the year 2000 through 2010. But you know, let's throw unrealistic numbers out of there. If he wants to hold to it, that's fine. But we're not using any of those numbers for our math. So let's look at the reality of Dave's plan and let's just look at a couple of case studies. So let's take a look at an individual that invests 15% of their household income into either, you know, Roth or pre-tax retirement IRAs. So case one. So Tom makes $40,000 a year and he invests 15% or $6,000 annually into a combination of pre-tax and post-tax accounts. And he does this every year for his working career, which is 40 years from the age of 20 to 60. He never gets a raise. And I realize that's unlikely, but he also never fails to contribute. So, you know, at retirement, he's going to have $1.6 million. So Tom has done it right. He followed Dave's advice. He's a millionaire. Sounds good, right? Maybe a second case, you know, Dick decides to go to medical school, 4 years of undergrad. He's 18 to, you know, from the year of 18 to 22, then 4 years of med school. You know, he finishes med school at 26, 4 to 5 years of residency, finishes at 30 or 31. And so basically it's the guy that does all the extra school. And because of that, he didn't start investing until he was a little bit later in life. Does that make sense? So now he's starting at the age of 30 and investing till 60.
Sounds a lot like you actually, right?
Yeah. Yeah. A little bit more modeled after me. So, but you know, this guy can only work for essentially, he's only planning on a 30-year working career. And so because he delayed his life, he got a higher income. He's making, let's just say, 100 grand just for easy math. And he invested 15%, which is $15,000 for 30 years. He's investing twice as much, but he only is making $1.8 million. So that's the only reason I wanted to do that is, again, one, to give you all a taste of what opportunity cost looks like. So because he had to wait that extra 10 years, he had to invest twice as much, basically to come out the same as the other guy that had a much smaller paycheck, had to invest much less. So they're basically coming out even. So that is opportunity cost. But even aside from that, the Choose FI community is not banking on 30 or 40 year working careers in order to get to retirement. You know, we are putting a lot of work in now so that we can, so that work can be optional going down the road, right? And for us, 5%, 10%, 15% of our annual income, you know, 15% savings rate, that is just not going to cut it if you plan on becoming financially independent in 5, 10, or 15 years. That's really my biggest problem with that. Dave's market is the person that is going to be the working for life. And this is not the 40-year career podcast. This is the Choose FI podcast. People in our space, we understand the importance of savings rate. And this is one of our biggest breaks with Dave Ramsey. We live far beneath our means, focusing on building passive income streams through investments, real estate, and business ventures. And I'm going to give a shout out to another podcaster that's in our space, Joshua Sheets from Radical Personal Finance. In fact, I think we're actually going to a conference next week where he's going to be there. Looking forward to that, Josh. He had a podcast, and I think this was a year or two back, and he aptly pointed out that if you want to experience Dave's level of success, don't do what he says, do what he did. And what did Dave do? He slashed his cost of living. He created space between his cost of living and his income. He built a business from the ground up, and then he scaled it to reach millions. And that's what we're doing here now. And you can be a part of that.
Yeah. And I think just to take a step back real quick is, you know, just looking at baby step four, 15% of your household income. That is really powerful for the people who are those hair is on fire type thing, right? Like that sounds probably like an unrealistic goal for many people.
Yeah.
And I think for those millions of people, this is an aspirational goal.
Yeah.
And if they can save 15% of their income, they're not going to be poor when they're 70, right? Like that's, and that is huge because how many millions of people have nothing saved up when they're 60 or 70? It's ridiculous. So 10 to 15%, that is a very admirable goal. But I hate to look at it as just some, again, some arbitrary dogmatic percentage. That makes no sense to me. For me, it's what do I need to live a life that I'm comfortable with,
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely.
So this is not, I save 15% off the top and I spend every other dollar. I mean, that would be ridiculous. Right. Like that makes no sense to me theoretically. So for me, it's I design the life that I want to live. I spend money on what I value, mm-hmm, and I save every other dollar. And if the next month there's something that I want to buy that I value, I buy it because I have the money. And that is a perfectly legitimate reason for me to buy something. And I'm completely happy with that. But this gives me the flexibility to do that, right? The way that I live, which is I don't save some arbitrary percentage. I save everything I possibly can.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you're exactly right. And also, I'm glad you went back to said that. There's a specific audience that probably I had in mind when I was thinking that through. But there's also millions of people, like you said, where 15% is almost unattainable. And so you start with where you're at, and then you figure out how to go from there. So thanks for pointing that out.
Yeah, you bet. And I think I admire Dave more than I probably realized, frankly, is going through these baby steps. I think he's doing such a service to millions of people. And we are going after a different audience, right? We're looking for the graduates of Dave Ramsey, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's where we're gonna go with this in a minute. I have kind of a jumping off platform at the end here. All right, baby step five, college funding for children. Because college is coming and it's expensive. I don't really have any issue with this. I don't care how you do it. You probably do need to prepare for your kids in some way, shape, or form. I don't necessarily think that you need to put it in specific accounts. I mean, you can. I'll get Brad's opinion on it. But if you build wealth for yourself and your family, your kids will benefit from that. So if there are tools available to you to channel that money to certain places, but most of the ones that I've heard have too many restrictions on it. I may do them as it fits the model and I can visualize it. But my bigger issue with college is just be smarter about it. Right now, you know, 2017, things are changing. don't be the person with a 300 CD collection and no way of listening to them. I mean, college is changing. The way that people are going to be getting their education is changing. Don't spend $100,000 on a college education if you don't have to, if you can get it for less. And I think it's not, so it's not just saving up 100, 150. It's figuring out how to be smart about it. Now, I'm not going to go really far into that because we have a whole other episode, but Brad, did you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I was just going to say the same thing, which is, you know, I suspect strongly we're going to have multiple episodes on how to save for college, how to hack a college education.
Yes.
I think, you know, that's something that we both feel very, very strongly about. You know, I have two young daughters and in the not too distant future, and, you know, this is something that's on our minds, right? And I guess just if I can talk real quickly about what we do, this is something I think about all the time because I don't know the right answer. I've actually joked with Brandon from the Mad Scientist is a good buddy of mine, and I admire him to the utmost. And you know what he does with figuring out the math of these situations is amazing. So I actually joke with him about coming up with some kind of Mad Scientist review of what the best decision is for saving for college. There are definitely ways to hack it. You talk about 529s.
529s and ESAs are the two tools that most people talk about, I know.
Yeah, and you know, we did set up a 529 account for both our girls.
Doesn't it lock you into a state?
It does not. Okay. So you, or at least as I understand it, so you do open it up with a particular state. So we have Virginia 529s. But I think as long as they check the boxes on being an accredited college and et cetera, you can tap that money for whatever college they go to, regardless of the state. But there are limitations. And, you know, also, what if my kids don't go to college, right? Yeah. Like, that's something I've thought about. Like, I don't want to be the bozo who oversaved in this 529 and then life intervened and we are locked up with that money and have to pay some onerous penalty on it. You know, that makes no sense. Or what if my kids get scholarships or something like that? So we've kind of split the difference, and I'm not sure that this is the right answer, quote unquote, but it's something that we're reasonably comfortable with. So we put a small amount of money in every month, whatever it is, $100 or $100 per girl, I think, per month, which is a tiny amount, sure, in the scheme of things, but over 18 years, it'll add up to something decent, and it'll pay for a year or two of their college if need be.
Absolutely.
So that's something I'm comfortable with. I don't feel like saving multiples of that because I'm simply not comfortable with that.
No, I'd be on the same page. All right. Baby step six, pay off your home early. This one's, you know, it's tough. I can see it either way. I think it's, the answer is maybe, or yes/maybe. I think probably part of that would be, what's your interest rate and what's the alternative and what's the cost of doing that? Like Brad said earlier, that I really appreciated, was we don't have any dogmas. You know, we're not dogmatic about anything. We just think it through and we're just hashing out these ideas. I think one of the questions would be specifically was, what is your interest rate? So, you know, if you have a 3% interest rate, wow, that's pretty good. That's money that you're keeping for free at 3%. And on top of that, it's free. I mean, it's taxpayer subsidized money. And on top of that, it's a platform for you to start itemizing. It is the number one thing that allows people to start itemizing their other deductions. So if you get rid of your mortgage, not only do you not deduct the interest, which is fine, I don't care about that, but it actually makes it harder for you to itemize other things because you have to then get to, you know, what for a married couple, $12,000.
Right, above the standard deduction.
Before, above the standard deduction. So it hurts you in a couple different ways.
Yeah, I've struggled with whether to pay off our mortgage early. And in full disclosure, right, that's what we're doing here on this podcast, is saying the good and the bad. And we have vacillated, my wife Laura and I have vacillated between paying a significant amount extra in principal every month to paying a tiny little bit, $100 a month or $200, and that would have accelerated it 8 years off the back end of the mortgage, which is pretty cool. So now we pay nothing extra. So, I mean, we have literally done essentially the three different options as I see it.
What if you had a 0% mortgage? Would you still pay it off? I mean, because it's debt, but it's not costing you anything. Is that a no-brainer?
I would not pay it off early in that scenario. Yeah. And, you know, honestly, even at 3-4%, I think we have a 3.75% mortgage rate. I look at it and say, okay, I mean, I'm clearly going to return better than that on investments unless something calamitous happens. So just mathematically, it doesn't make sense. But also, you could look at it again psychologically, right? That's what we talk about a lot.
That's the only case you could make for paying off a 0% mortgage, would be just the psychology of having less than expenses, because you're basically saying, you know, I'm willing to not invest $200,000 or $100,000 or whatever that number is. You know, I'm willing to not invest that so I can get this done. There is a real cost to doing that.
Yeah. And I mean, also, you know, my mortgage, my entire mortgage payment for pretty nice 4-bedroom house in a, you know, upscale neighborhood in Richmond is, I think it's like $1,140 or something like that. I mean, it's, and that's in,
does that include all, your property tax?
That includes property taxes, insurance, and our principal. Wow. So, right. So, I mean, that's not all expense. I mean,
right.
You know, I'll be paying that same $1,100 25 years from now. It just in purchasing power, what is $1,100 30 years from now? I mean, it's going to be peanuts. Sure. So
right.
I've definitely thought about that as, you know, a reason to not pay it off early.
What would be the cutoff at which point you'd say, you know what, we probably either got to do this or refinance it. Would it be 6%, 5%?
Yeah. I mean, that's a tough call. I mean, I think it depends. It depends what the prevailing interest rate is. Not to give you a cop-out answer, but can you refinance, right? I mean, if it's 3.5% is the prevailing, do you refinance and pay a couple $1,000 in interest rates? I mean, in closing costs?
So I think we're going to kind of just walk away from this one. I mean, it's just, you know, maybe pay off home early isn't just a blanket statement that you make. Maybe it's situational and really can't be applied. I mean, it's a math problem. It's a psychology problem. It's not a super simple thing to answer, although there may be a specific answer for everybody.
Agreed.
All right. So this brings us, you know, more or less to the end. This is baby step 7. And this is probably the most disappointing part of the Dave Ramsey plan. And Dave says, build wealth and give. That literally is the end of his book. And you've come through all these steps. You've kind of walked to the end and it's not very inspiring. In fact, it's kind of boring. Like for instance, you don't need to wait to get to the other side to give. I mean, I gave the whole way through, you know, through my tithes and offerings and that sort of thing. I mean, you don't need to be a jerk when you're going through these other steps. If you can do it, you should be doing all those things. But then once you get to the other side, your final bullet point just says build wealth and give. I really would like to flesh that out.
Yeah. I mean, this means essentially nothing to me.
Yeah. So, you know, give me some sizzle. You know who does a great job with sizzle, you know, sizzle of the steak, that sort of thing. Pyramid schemes. You always know when you found a pyramid scheme, when they start telling you about the free cars that you're going to have and the $1 million lifestyle you're going to, you know, you're going to have and the island you're going to own. As soon as you start working with them on your own little business where you can hire 5 people and they can hire 5 people and all this stuff. Well, I'm not really talking about that either, but I think we should flesh out what are some of these opportunities. And I think we can do a better job than Dave did for whatever reason. I don't know why he just gave up on this one, but there are a lot of doors that open up for you once you reach financial independence.
Yeah, it definitely seems like Dave mailed it in here.
He totally did. I think he got tired of writing.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to we're going to take 2 or 3 minutes and we're just going to, you know, bounce off some ideas for you. So you're financially independent. Your life costs nothing now. Your investments, which are maybe you have $300,000, $400,000 in a some sort of retirement account or taxable account. You know, that's bringing in $1,000, $2,000 a month, something like that. Your expenses are only $25,000 a year because you followed all these pieces of advice you've gotten, your cost of living really low. You know, what's next for you? And while I'm not going to give you every single little thing that you could possibly do, it would just take too long. I think you should be considering that you do have a lot more options than you used to. And I don't think for me, and everybody's a little bit different, I don't think for me that I'm ever going to be the guy that jet sets around the world and has the Lambo out in the driveway and it's not to have this opulent, crazy lifestyle. I'm very happy as a middle-class American, just the things that we have now. I'm extraordinarily satisfied, but I do think that I enjoy working on these smaller projects. I enjoy building something from scratch. And I think that just building businesses one at a time and talking about people that share my interest and then working on co-projects with them, I think it's freedom. I think that's probably the word I would have used instead of build wealth and give. I think it would have been freedom. And that's what we're doing. That's a choice that Brad and I are making every single day. We're trying to figure out what tools and what projects can we invest our time in that will give us more freedom and whatever that is.
Yeah. Freedom and flexibility, yeah. Right? I mean, what's the most finite of resources? Time.
Time. Right? You're running out of it. Yeah.
Yep. Every single day it ticks away. And, you know, most people go to their 9 to 5 and commute 30 minutes each way. And that's difficult. And we obviously understand that you need to do that, right? You need to do that, but there has to be some end to it, right? Like there has to be that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And that is achieved by saving money.
Because right? You were born to do more than pay bills and die.
Yeah. I mean, it can't be your life. We get 80, 90 years on this rock and we need to enjoy it and we need to maximize it and do what you're passionate about, right? And obviously you have to work. You have to work to get to this financial independence state. But man, after that, if you make everything in service of getting to your FI number, and that doesn't mean depriving yourself along the way, but it means just being aware of it. If you can get to FI and then you have decades ahead of yourself, you can explore things that you enjoy that, you know, maybe you didn't even know was available to you, right? Mm-hmm. You can connect with people. Like Jonathan said, you can learn new things. You can make partnerships with people you would have never thought possible. And that is really powerful. And again, it all comes back to freedom.
So let's say that I'm very close to step seven, which, yeah, okay, I'm getting there. For me, there's a couple things that I'm going to do. One, I reject Dave Ramsey's approach on taking out debt for real estate. I have no problem with it. He crashed and burned, but there were a lot of other circumstances surrounding that. I feel like there's probably a better way of doing it than he did it. And so I plan on tiptoeing into real estate, starting a couple businesses. So I started two new businesses this year. Now, neither of them have made me a single dollar. I think that it's important to point that out. I have not earned a single penny yet in passive income from my businesses. And I am completely okay with that because I plan on growing them, and they will return money for me at some point. And I am growing them from scratch, and it's pretty cool. I mean, I'm learning a bunch of new skills. It's engaging my brain. I'm planning on starting two more businesses next year. So, I mean, these are different things that I am approaching and enjoying. Also, I'm learning new skills like travel hacking. Dave Ramsey hates credit cards. He hates them. And you know, he's talked to a lot of people where they have ruined their lives. But that doesn't mean that we need to completely throw out credit cards. Credit cards have a very useful place in my life. And we're able to use credit cards to allow us to travel the world for free and without spending a single extra dollar, to still be extremely frugal and self-controlled and get $5,000 to $10,000 in free travel each year. Nobody knows about that. And you'll never know about that if you're only listening to Dave Ramsey, by actually talking to other people and learning new techniques. And actually, that was one of the things I learned when I met Brad, is just this wonderful world of travel hacking, that there are literally hundreds of thousands of people that have figured out a way to travel the world for free. And that's another thing that I'm looking into, and it's been a lot of fun. And I think y'all are going to get experience a little bit of that. So one of the things that we want to do is we want to, one, share with you where we've been and where we're going. And two, the things that we have discovered, the things that we're really good at, how we got there, what our decision tree was, how you can get started if you want to do that. And we want to make your life simpler. We want to make your life less expensive. And then we want to open up doors for you if you want to try some of the things that we're trying.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, so I want to give a shout out to Zeus34, who left us our first written comment. Thank you. Thank you so much. It means a lot to us. So just so y'all know, iTunes ranks written comments a little bit more heavily than just clicking the 1 through 5 on there. And so if you're enjoying the show, if you enjoyed the show today, please go on there and leave us a written review. It really does help us out. We want to incentivize it. And so one of the things that Brad and I have talked about is we are going to add a voicemail feature onto the show, where you're actually going to be able to go directly to our website and you can leave us a message. And if you package it the right way, so you ask us a good question, something that allows us to answer it in the right format, it has to help more than just you. It has to help maybe you plus other people that would benefit from that topic. We'll actually be able to talk about it on the show, maybe even get some other experts involved to have them talk about it as well. It could be really cool. But there is a cost to actually having this feature on our website. And so we want to offer our first of many ethical bribes. So ethical bribe, if y'all are not familiar with that term, is one where we give you an incentive that helps you out, and in exchange, you help us out. And this is going to be a win-win for both of us. So if you would be okay doing that, we would so appreciate it if you would go onto the iTunes website. Then you would click on ratings and reviews and leave us a 5-star review, and then just leave us a comment as well, just letting us know that you appreciate the show. Thank you so much for listening today, and we'll see you next time on The Road Less Traveled.